think it must have been about 30 years ago. We were sitting down as a family to our Easter lunch, roast lamb, of course. And my elder daughter, who at that point was 7 or 8, turned to me and she said, "Daddy, will you kill me?" And I said, "Oh, why do you want me to kill you?" And she said, "So that I can rise again 3 days later like Jesus did." Now, I know there's a big difference between childish faith, which is what she was displaying, and childlike faith, which most of us aspire to and never quite achieve. In case you're wondering, I declined her request. Although there'd be, no, I won't go into that. But I would have to say, as I kind of look on, having been a follower of Jesus now for longer than I want to own up to, I think. I think I'm about on my half century of following Jesus now. There are times when I just haven't got that incredible faith which my daughter displayed. And I find it reassuring when I read the Easter story to discover I'm not on my own. That actually the Easter story is kind of full of awe and wonder and amazement and celebration. And yet at the same time lurking around in the story, there's all sorts of fears and doubts. When Jesus appeared to them on that first Easter day evening, John tells us the disciples were together with doors locked for the fear of the Jews. And I want to think for a moment about what causes us to be fearful, what causes us to doubt, because I think until we address that, we can't really think about the incredible significance of the resurrection and what it means in the way that God deals with our fears and our doubts. So what makes us fear? I think the story from John's Gospel suggests that we get afraid of them, those people who are out to get us because we're followers of Jesus. And of course, the disciples of Jesus had just cause to be fearful. After all, the Jewish authorities had just crucified Jesus. And I think there are people worshipping God this Easter Sunday for whom fear of that sort of violence is a present-day reality. And I sometimes wonder how I would respond if I was in one of those places. And then I thank God that I'm not. And pray for those who are. For us, the kind of opposition is slightly less obvious, but actually no less, well no, it is less painful, but it's still painful when we're mocked for following Jesus. I find it worse when people condescend. Oh yes, I used to go to church, but I grew out of it. And you can hear what they're not saying. When are you going to? Never, I hope. But you know, I don't think those are the worst fears. I think the worst fears are the ones that come from inside us, not from outside. Have you ever kind of sat through an Easter service? You may be sitting through this one thinking, you know, I'm really not sure I can believe this stuff. Did it really happen? Did God really sent his son to live as a man? Did the Son of God really die on the cross? Did he rise again 3 days later? And we're talking about resurrection, not resuscitation. There's a difference. There are plenty of stories of incompetent doctors who've said, no, apologies to any doctors in the house, who've said that people are dead when they're not. But that isn't what happened to Jesus. The story tells us clearly he was dead. But then 3 days later, he wasn't. And he physically rose from the dead. And it's not surprising that people find that hard to believe, because in the normal human way of thinking, it doesn't actually make sense, does it? It's literally incredible. Although, sometimes when I want to really do my head in, I've got a very good friend who's an astrophysicist, and I remember him telling me years ago that we've got it down so that we know what happens until I think it was 48 to the power of 18th of a second before the Big Bang, or after the Big Bang, sorry. And there's part of me that always wants to say, well, that's really good, but what happened before that? What was there before the Big Bang? What's there beyond where we can see? Does that make your head hurt? And you see, I think sometimes we do live in a world where we think we have to be able to answer everything, and actually we can't. Our brains aren't big enough. Our generation probably knows more than any other generation before it, and we still know a fraction of what can be known about this wonderful universe. So don't dismiss something because it's incredible. It may still be true. But the problem is, of course, that trying to rationally answer these questions is very often, in fact most often in my experience, unsatisfactory. Because as we seek to explain, we find we can't. And actually, one of the things I've discovered over many years is actually when I'm frightened, I don't actually want anybody to be reasonable. It annoys me. Does that work with you? Because fear is an emotion. It doesn't respond to reason. Emotions respond to emotions. So if we're not going to be able to think our way, explain our way out of our fears, where do we go? Of course, if we're truly British, we just put on a stiff upper lip and pretend we don't worry about it. But actually, that doesn't work either, does it? But as we look at this Easter story, time after time, as a story unfolds, people's fears and doubts are dealt with in the same way. They're dealt with because people meet the risen Jesus. So in the beginning of the story, which we've just heard, it's Mary. I always think it's wonderful in that male-dominated hierarchical Jewish society that the first person to meet the risen Christ couldn't even testify about it in a court of law because her testimony was invalid. I think that just kind of shows God's sense of humour. And not only was she a woman, but she was a woman with a distinctly dodgy background. And she was the first to meet Jesus after he rose from the dead. Doesn't that tell you something about the nature of God that's really good? And doesn't that tell you when you and I get all po-faced and start looking down at people who don't know how to behave in church and don't know how to live as Christians, that actually we're not looking at them the way God does? He looks at them with love, not judgment. But then you can, as the story unfolds, you've got the road to Emmaus, you've got Cleopas and his friend whose name we never find out. That anonymous man with Cleopas on the road to Emmaus who eventually realised they were walking along with Jesus. They were quite slow on the uptake. That gives me hope as well, because I'm quite often slow on the uptake. And then the disciples, the story which we ended our reading this morning with. And then if we'd gone on, we could have met poor old Thomas. He wasn't there. So he said, no, I'm not going to believe it just because you tell me. I'll only believe it when I meet Jesus for myself. And of course he did. And then if you read on through Acts, you'll find that the last appearance recorded in the Bible of someone meeting Jesus was Paul on the Damascus Road. But see, that's not the end, is it though? That's not the end of the story. That's barely the beginning. Because ever since that time, throughout the history of the church and the world, people have been meeting Jesus. I'm a good enough Methodist to know it was on May the 24th, 1738, when John Wesley said his heart was strangely warmed. He encountered the risen Jesus up until then, he'd been trying his very best and working harder than all of us ever will in trying to be faithful to God and making a mess of it. But his life and his ministry only came alive when his heart was strangely warmed as he encountered Jesus. One of the first churches where I was minister was the Clowes Memorial Methodist Church. I love the story of how William Clowes, he was one of the leaders of Primitive Methodism. If you've never heard of Primitive Methodists, they weren't the original ones. They were the ones who tried to rediscover Primitive Methodism because Methodism had already lost its way at the beginning of the 19th century. And William Clowes, he was part of the Wedgwood family. He was a notorious gambler and drinker. He'd spent most of his early adult life actually in the city of Hull, which is where I encountered the Clowes Memorial Methodist Church. But after his mother died, suddenly he felt, I've got to receive communion. He didn't really know why, he just knew that he had to. Now, in those days, it's not like today where when we get to the bit where the communion is served, I'll say, anybody who wants to, come and have bread and wine. In those days, you had to be a member and have a class ticket. And they actually checked at the door to see your class ticket was up to date. And you were actually properly attending church and attending class meeting and being a faithful follower of Jesus before you were allowed to receive communion. But William Clowes was a ceramic designer, so forging a class ticket was no problem. So he forged one. And he stood in the queue waiting to get in while the class tickets were being checked. And as he looked at the other people in the queue, he realised he'd forged it from memory, and his memory wasn't very good. His forgery was abysmal, and it was never going to pass muster when the steward at the door checked it. And it was an evening communion service. He got to the front of the queue, and just as he was about to hand over this membership class ticket, which he knew would not convince the steward, his candle blew out, and so he stopped him. And he relit the candle and he reached for the class ticket again and the candle blew out again. So the steward stopped him and he relit the candle and a third time as he reached for it, it blew out and the steward said, oh, go on in. And in that communion service, William Clowes encountered the risen Christ. And he set out to be not just a faithful follower of Jesus, but he actually set out, he went back to Hull because he said, that's where I did my worst sinning, so that's where I've got to go and put things right. And he went back to the places where he'd been a bad influence and became a good influence. And by the end of his life, he said he could walk from Hull to Newcastle, across to Carlisle and back to Hull, preaching every night in a church that he had planted. Amazing. But of course, that's kind of not the end of it. That's an almost 200-year-old story now. But I want to tell you a couple of much more recent stories. They're actually getting older than I realised when I sat down thinking about it. But I want to tell you about Harry. Harry was the granddad of a man who came to Christ on the Alpha Course at a church I was minister of. He actually became a Christian by running the London Marathon, but that's another story. Ask me later if you want. And Phil had more or less been brought up by his gran and his granddad, and he was desperate that they would find faith. Now, his grandmother, I think, had always had faith, but his granddad very definitely didn't. And Harry was a militant atheistic communist. And, you know, he absolutely loved the Alpha Course. It was the best argument he'd ever had. And he came every week and he said, this is a load of rubbish, I don't believe any of it. And he came to all the sessions of the Alpha Course, and by the end of it he was still saying, this is a load of rubbish, but I really like you lot, can we keep on meeting? And I remember him saying to me one Sunday in church, he said, the chat in this coffee lounge after service is better than the chat in any pub I've ever been in. He was softening, but he still hadn't really encountered Jesus. He just encountered the followers of Jesus. And he was in hospital and he was dying. His wife had died the year before. And he was reasonably convinced that his wife was a Christian. And although he didn't believe in it, he hoped she'd gone to heaven. And I went to visit him in hospital. And he said, I'm really glad you've come. I've got something to tell you. And I said, oh, what's that? He said, last night, said, I was wide awake in the middle of the night. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was laid in my bed. He said, I was shaking with fear because I'm dying and I don't know what's going to happen to me and I don't know where I'm going. And I'm finally beginning to wonder, if there is a hell, is that where I'm going? And he said, I heard footsteps in the ward. And they walked down the ward. And because he was in the final stages of dying, his curtains were around his bed to give him some privacy. He said, the curtains opened. He said, and Jesus walked in. And he sat on my bed. And he said, don't worry, Harry, you're going to be with me. He lived about a week longer. And in that week, he called every member of his family who he'd spent nearly 80 years of his life telling them that God didn't exist and he was an atheist and told them how Jesus had sat on his bed and told him he was going to be all right. And then a different story. This one's weird, I warn you. I think stories are often weird. And I think sometimes as good Methodists, we think, if this doesn't make sense, I don't want anything to do with it. And if it's emotional, I definitely don't want anything to do with it. But this is a very emotional story, and it's a weird emotional story, because when I was... It was the same church, actually, where Harry was a member. Eventually, well, he never quite became a member, but he met Jesus. And we were there in the 90s when the whole kind of Toronto blessing thing was happening and the Holy Spirit was doing some quite strange things. And he seemed to do quite a lot in our church. It was the most exciting and the most challenging part of my ministry ever, I think. And we had services, special services on Sunday evenings where we just invited the Holy Spirit to come and tried to work out what was happening. And quite a lot of the time we didn't know and we just tried to be open to God and hope that it would come clear eventually. And there was this one particular lady. She was a mum in her, I guess, 30s at that point. She had two teenage children. She'd recently been divorced. And every time that we offered prayer ministry, she came down to the front of the church, and it was not unlike this, actually. She always went to that corner. And the moment somebody went to pray with her, she fell on the floor and sobbed. Not quietly. Absolute heart-wrenching cries, tears. And she didn't just do this once, she did it for weeks. And several of the stewards kind of came to me and said, you know, you're going to have a word with her, Graham. You know, this it's undignified. And I said, I know it's undignified, but I still have this sense that God's in it and we're going to work it out eventually what's happening. And eventually, probably after a couple of months, she came to me and she said, can I tell my story next Sunday? And I said, I would absolutely love to know what's been going on. Please tell your story. And she stood up in church next Sunday and she said, I've been so embarrassed. I know I've been laying down there at the front every Sunday for weeks, sobbing my heart out, and I didn't know why, and I couldn't stop myself, and it felt right, but I didn't know why. And she said, then last week something happened. She said, I met with my ex-husband. It had been a very painful divorce. Her husband had betrayed her, and then been as unhelpful as possible in the divorce proceedings. And she knew as a Christian she should forgive him, but she really couldn't. And she kept saying, I'm going to forgive him, I'm going to forgive him. And then I wish I could kill him. And she said, I met up with my ex-husband. And I felt no anger. I felt no resentment. I felt no betrayal. And she said, all those nights when I've been laying at the front of the church, sobbing my heart out, Jesus has been there, healing me of the hurt of my broken marriage. The answer to fear, the answer to doubt, the answer to hurt is found in meeting Jesus. What about you? What about me? Have we had that kind of encounter with Jesus? And if we have, Was it maybe so long ago we've forgotten and need another one? In a moment, we're going to pray and then we're going to sing. And then, I don't know how often you do this, but in the notes for preachers, it says that you have a My Story slot here at Trinity Woking every Sunday-ish. I'm looking around when it happens. And I just wonder, and I'm giving you a whole song to think about it, but I'll warn you, it's a fairly short song. Would you like to tell the story of how you encountered Jesus? Maybe not how you first became a Christian, although that would be good. Maybe another encounter with Jesus at another moment in your life. And so I'm going to invite, when we've sung the next song, which is actually reminding us that Jesus is here, standing in our midst, to meet with us. I'm going to invite you, if you would wish to come and tell your story. And I don't know whether we'll put the timer on. In the same church that both those stories happened in, I used to have a youth worker, and when he got the kids to tell their stories, he would put a lit match in their hand and say, "You can't blow the match out till you've finished your story." It focused the mind wonderfully. I'm sure it's not allowed nowadays. Short stories. But maybe God's just saying to you, yeah, actually, it would be really good to say how I met Jesus. Let's pray.